Bueno, como va a ocurrir con todos los invitados que tenemos aquí, es difícil sintetizar sus aportaciones a nivel científico, pero bueno, algo hay que decir y por tanto, bueno, vamos a resumir un poco en este caso a Tom Nixon. Él culmina sus estudios en el Coulthard Institute of Art de Londres y actualmente es profesor de la Universidad de York. Es especialista en arte medieval, tanto en arquitectura como en cultura visual y en especial de la península ibérica. Primero abordó sus estudios en arquitectura gótica, en concreto acerca de los usos sacros y profanos de los espacios, para después interrogarse sobre las conexiones entre arte y devoción en el arte hispano medieval como consecuencia de las conexiones entre las tradiciones cristiana, judía y musulmana. Su tesis doctoral, dirigida por Paul Crossley, titulada Toledo Cathedral, Art and Belief in Medieval Castile, fue en esta línea. Recientemente ha participado en la última monografía publicada sobre la Catedral de Toledo, la Catedral Primada de Toledo, 18 siglos de historia, con el capítulo The Building History of Toledo Cathedral. Entre otros ítems que constatan su relevancia investigadora, es miembro del proyecto internacional centrado en Santiago de Compostela, Literary and Visual Culture in the Crown of Castile. Es director del Medieval and Medievalism Research School del Departamento de Historia de Arte de York y además es editor de los Visual Art Issue of Hispanic Research Journal. Por otra parte, ha participado en numerosos congresos y seminarios, también evidentemente con su repercusión publicada. Entre otros, hemos destacado el Toledo Cathedral Choir Screen and the Debate of Over Images in Late Medieval Castile, Ritual and Violence in Toledo, que fue en febrero de 2008, The Presbytery of Toledo Cathedral in the Early 13th Century, y finalmente Gates of Paradise Getting into Medieval Spain, donde coincidió con Claudia Rucker, entre otros investigadores que tenemos aquí. Muchísimas gracias, te cedo la palabra, creo que hablarás en inglés. Pues bueno, ahora.
Vale, gracias.
Gracias por aceptar la invitación.
Vale, yo agradezco a Gerardo Boto y el proyecto por haberme invitado a este congreso que ya me ha dado mucho placer, sobre todo antes de este momento. Yo no tenía la confianza de hablar en castellano, pero si no me entienden, hay que decirme y puedo tratar de explicar un poco en castellano. Vale, voy a... Gracias. The image of Toledo has transformed radically in the last century from fortress of the conservative church to icon of convivencia. In the histories and pseudo-histories that flourished in medieval and early modern Toledo, the city was celebrated as the home of the Visigothic councils, site of the Virgin's 7th century descent to Sant Ildefonso, and primatial church of all Spain. But as Madrid and Seville flourished, from the 1560s onwards, Toledo abandoned all pretensions to political or commercial power. It would become the heart and bastion of Catholic Spain, home to unparalleled numbers of nuns, monks, and pious seminarians. With the nationwide confiscation of church properties in the 1830s, Toledo lost its once famed riches. And to 19th century writers like Blasquez Ibáñez and Richard Ford, it was a city in decay, full of coughing canons who wandered through their miserable lives in an endless cycle of ossified rituals and damp cloisters. During the Spanish Civil War, Toledo's profile became starker yet. At different moments, both sides claimed responsibility for protecting its innumerable treasures. Seen as either religious or artistic patrimony, depending on your point of view. In the end, of course, it was the former that won out, and Toledo's role as guardian of conservative Catholicism became ever more entrenched. Even to this day, the cathedral treasury proudly displays Franco's sword, gifted to the cathedral in 1939 alongside other precious relics and treasures. So there's a saw which is now in Toledo Cathedral Treasury. I couldn't get a photo in the treasury, but this is as close as I could get. Yet even under Franco, powerful forces were set in motion that would challenge this view of Toledo. The promotion of tourism from the 1950s onwards saw the arrival of millions of wealthy, scantily clad Europeans and Americans who brought with them much needed hard currency, but also liberal politics that challenged local traditions. At first, these tourists rarely ventured far from the coast, but the opening of the first Parador in Santiago de Compostela in 1954 signaled a new determination to capitalize on Spain's historic and religious centers. Toledo was an easy journey from Madrid, and soon the first tourist coaches started heaving their way through its narrow streets. Although I think this lady with her shoes wouldn't get very far in Toledo. Mass tourism had come to Toledo and began to refashion Toledo's image into the rather tacky tourist site that it is today. Sword shops sprung up on every corner. And I have to thank my research assistant, Google Images, for this. I particularly like this game that you can buy for, I suppose, about 30 euros, where you can make swords yourself. And while these contributed to a revival of local craft traditions, they have also muddied perceptions of Toledan history. So I've noticed, for instance, recently that a lot of shops sell Lord of the Rings souvenirs. Not that this has anything to do with Toledo, clearly. Those solemn nuns have also been recast, famed for making the sweetest marzipan, from which even new churches are constructed. So this is a famous marzipan church in Toledo. High rents have transformed the historic centre into a ghost town of hotels and souvenir shops, staffed by a population that has retreated to new developments in the valley outside Toledo's walls. Car parks have been excavated out of the city itself, uncovering hidden archaeological treasures that are promptly covered with concrete. And the hillside, once celebrated by El Greco, is now scarred by a mechanical escalator that rises to the city's heights. Yet mass tourism also had more profound effects on the way we understand Toledo. In the United States, Americo Castro's vision of Spain's melting pot, syncretic history, had long been accepted and gradually found favor as Spain sought a new identity following Franco's death in 1975. It is telling that when Toledo was declared a World Heritage Site in 1986, the UNESCO committee explained, and I quote, that its masterpieces are the product of heterogeneous civilizations in an environment where the existence of three major religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, was a major factor. 1992 marked an even more significant turning point for Toledo. The 500th anniversary of the conquest of Granada, expulsion of Jews, and the landings in America precipitated a nationwide reassessment of Spain's position in global history. Major academic conferences were held in New York, Jerusalem, and Granada. A Camino de Sefarad had been established in Spain as early as 1990 as part of an effort to attract wealthy Jewish tourists from Israel and the US. And in 1994, Toledo's Museo Sefardí here was opened in the converted synagogue of El Tránsito. Since then, as anyone who's been to Toledo will know, hundreds of tourist trips and brochures have celebrated Toledo as the city of Tres Culturas. Its earlier conservative image now shed, Toledo has come to represent the embodiment of convivencia, in which Jews, Muslims, and Christians happily live together. And this, of course, took on an additional political dimension following 9/11, the Madrid bombings of 2004, and massive North African immigration into southern Spain. Not for nothing does the Andalusian regional government subsidize David Barenboim's Western Eastern Orchestra. But these narratives have repercussions in academia too. We can see these in dozens of congresses on convivencia that are held in Toledo each year, many of them subsidized by regional funding bodies. Toledan buildings are also found on the covers of two recent bestsellers that have presented a particularly positive view of Toledo's hybrid culture. Yet there's a striking absence in these new accounts, for Toledo Cathedral is barely mentioned at all in them. In Arts of Intimacy, for instance, which came out in 2008, 9 pages are devoted to the Toledan parish church of San Roman, consecrated by Archbishop Rodrigo Jiménez de Rada in 1221. The Gothic cathedral that Rodrigo founded in the same decade merits only 1 page. True enough, there have been hundreds of studies of the cathedral in the past 2 centuries, yet they belong to a wholly different discourse, one still peddled by the cathedral authorities. Scarred by memories of the Civil War, those authorities are instinctively conservative, wary of academic investigation. The same old myths survive in their official guidebooks, even when long ago debunked by scholars in the US and Canada. Photography in the cathedral is expressly forbidden, apparently in order to preserve its sanctity. Yet nothing disrupts that sanctity more than the regular loudspeaker announcements that forbid photographs, or the security guards who think nothing of speaking loudly on their mobile phones or sneaking into the cloister for a cigarette. One cannot help thinking that this ban on photography may also have something to do with the fact that the cathedral shop sells outrageously expensive colour posters and booklets on the cathedral. Such impediments to serious scholarly investigation are compounded by the notorious difficulty of using the cathedral archives and have serious consequences. So in the last decade, for instance, we've seen the publication of a number of extraordinary and revolutionary studies on cathedrals like Sevilla, Lleida, Gerona, well, lesser Gerona actually, and thanks to Gerardo León, to name but a few. But in the same period, there's been virtually nothing on the medieval art and architecture of Toledo Cathedral. And this exclusion from the academic discourse has long-term effects, making it harder to attract outside funding for restoration work, or, if it were ever allowed, archaeological investigation. This has meant, for instance, that the cathedral authorities have relied on Iberdrola, the Spanish energy giant, to finance the recent restoration of the San Blas Chapel. This, to be sure, was much needed, but I suspect that the chapel's very heavy restoration was not unrelated to the desire to create glossy books for Iberdrola's clients. It is doubtless clear from this brief summary that as a British non-Catholic student of Toledo Cathedral, I have my own share of frustrations and anxieties, though I have also enjoyed many positive moments too. But what I find particularly striking is the way that this division of these histories has a history of its own. In many respects, the two parallel histories of Toledo that I have sketched follow the lines drawn up by Claudio Sanchez Albornoz and Americo Castro in the 1950s and 60s, one stressing the continuity of Toledo's Christian heritage, the other celebrating it as a kind of medieval Manhattan, a melting pot of different cultures. But these binaries go back even further to the very foundation of Toledo Cathedral. In 1236, the old caliphal capital of Cordoba was captured, its mosque converted into a cathedral. Shortly thereafter, Archbishop Rodrigo of Toledo was penning the section of his great Spanish history, the De Rebus Hispaniae, that described Toledo's own conquest in 1085 and the conversion of its mosque. According to his well-known narrative, Alfonso VI had sworn at Toledo's submission that its Muslim inhabitants could continue to use their Friday mosque. But aided by Alfonso's wife, Constance of Burgundy, Toledo's French bishop, Bernard of Cedirac, sneaked into the mosque by night and consecrated it as a cathedral. Alfonso, furious that his promise had been broken, could only be placated by the leader of Toledo's Muslims, who selflessly freed Alfonso from his oath. There are, of course, good reasons to be skeptical of Rodrigo's tale of betrayal and reconciliation. Yet it encapsulates the way that those writing about Toledo have positioned it between Christian Northern Europe and Islamic Southern Spain, a pivot and point of encounter between two alien traditions. This same binary has been present in the writings of architectural historians ever since. In the 1860s, the great English architect and scholar George Edmund Street travelled to Spain in search of a proper Christian architectural idiom of his own. In some account of Gothic architecture, published in 1865, Street definitively claimed Toledo for the Gothic Christian camp, and I quote at length. "The church is thoroughly French in its ground plan, and equally French in all its details of some height from the ground. And it is not until we reach the triforium of the choir that any other influence is visible. But even here, the work is French work, only slightly modified by some acquaintance with Moorish art, and not to such an extent as to be recognised as Mooresque anywhere else but here in the close neighbourhood of which so much suggests the probability of it all being so." He's very wordy, Street. "The whole work is indeed a grand protest against Mohammedan architecture. And I doubt whether any city in the Middle Ages can show anything so distinctly intended and so positive in its opposition to what was being done at the same time by other architects as this." It is the extraordinary design of the triforium here in the presbytery of Toledo Cathedral that I want to consider in the second part of this paper. How can we account for this triforium? How have people written about it? And how can it make us reflect on our own practice as architectural historians? So I'm going to be focusing for the rest of the paper really on the design of this, the unprecedented design of this triforium found at the east end of Toledo Cathedral, as you can see there. Street was not, of course, the first to remark on the Moorishness of Spanish Gothic architecture. In 1850, guided by Sir Christopher Wren's theories on the Saracenic origins of Gothic architecture, the English MP David Urquhart speculated that Gothic architecture properly derived its name from the Goths of Spain. James Murphy had distorted the proportions of the Alhambra to make it more closely resemble a Gothic cloister. So you can see here in this lithograph of the Alhambra that Murphy has stretched the proportions so that they look more Gothic. And throughout the 19th century, writers understood Toledo's mixed or hybrid forms in typically racial terms and in opposition to the cathedral's pure Gothic forms. More recently, scholars who pride themselves for their ability to trace the most distant ancestry for the most obscure Gothic forms have been content with casual descriptions of Islamic influence. Jean Bonnet alluded to Toledo's, and I quote, mosque-like interiors. Paul Frankel wrote of, quote, the very Mudéjar-looking multi-cuffed arches in the triforia. Whilst for Christopher Wilson, Toledo's triforium was simply discreetly Islamicized. Yet as early as the 1920s, the great French scholar Elie Lombert, equally familiar with Gothic and Andalusian architecture, pinpointed a possible model for Toledo's triforium. Detecting une saveur hispano-mauresque in the triforium design, Lombert proposed that it might imitate features of Toledo's converted mosque cathedral, still partially standing as its Gothic replacement was built. Sadly, nothing is known about the elevations of this Toledan mosque, though it's possible it may have imitated Cordoba's great mosque. Lombert also highlighted the resemblance to the interlaced arches found in the Cordoban mosque, converted into a cathedral in 1236, and more specifically those in the Maxura area, which date to the 960s. So Lombert compared this very strange design in the presbytery to this design in the Maxura area of the Great Mosque. And I think at first it's quite hard to see this similarity. But the easiest way I find is to think about the negative spaces, as it were. So if we match, for instance, this space with this area, we can do the same with the upper areas here. And with these bits at the side. So I think that's what Lombert was talking about. There's the same basic structure. It is an appealing idea, and several other Christian copies of Cordoba's Maxura can be found across Spain, for instance here at Tordesillas. Yet splendid as they are, Cordoba's Maxura screens are hardly a perfect match for Toledo's triforium. So, for instance, these very distinctive horseshoe arches that we find in the Maxura find no equivalent in Toledo. More similar, in my view, are the intersecting arches in the Villa Viciosa Chapel in Cordoba Cathedral. So there's another way of reading these this triforium design at Toledo. Rather than thinking about the negative spaces, you can think of it as a combination of multi-lobed arches, either with five lobes, as we have here in the Villa Viciosa Chapel, or indeed with seven, all intersecting, rather like we have it here. And these arches here in the Villa Viciosa Chapel would seem in a particularly appropriate model for Toledo's presbytery triforium, for Cordoba's high altar was originally located directly in front of them. So after 1236, the high altar of Cordoba was just here. It's since been moved. This is also where the Infante Juan of Castile was buried in 1246, 15 years before his half-brother Sancho, Archbishop of Toledo, was buried behind Toledo's high altar. So by the 1240s, this area was already associated with royal burial, even if the chapel behind it wasn't established till later. And in 1261, at his death, Archbishop Sancho of Toledo, brother of Alfonso X, was buried almost certainly below these arches. There is, I think, a certain logic to these kinds of comparisons, but there are problems too. Could this design also be compared to the interlaced arches on Seville's Giralda, famously celebrated in contemporary chronicles? So in fact, I think particularly this lower part is quite similar to what we have at Toledo. And if the Giralda, Seville's conquest in 1248 and the subsequent conversion of its mosque took place just a few years before construction of Toledo's triforium. But if the Giralda is a possible model, why not contemporary Toledan churches with similar features? So this is just two diagrams, much less professional than Claudia's, of the construction of Toledo. So here we can see it in 1238. We see that parts of the old mosque are still standing and the outer chapels are complete. But by the 1280s, that choir was complete. So the presbytery triforium, which is this section here, seems to be built in the 1250s for various reasons for thinking that. But if we can think of the Giralda at Seville, why not other Toledan buildings with interlaced polyload arches, as we see here in the west front of Santiago del Arrabal? These would, and might even this be the work of Muslim or Mudéjar craftsmen? I think we can discount the possibility that Toledo's presbytery was built by Muslim craftsmen, following Henrik Karger's observation that Toledo's triforium is built quite differently from the other examples. Rather than being constructed of brick, conceived as voussoirs, Toledo's triforium is built vertically with specially shaped blocks of stone, as in the earlier portico of San Juan de Duero. So here you can see at Santiago de Arrabal that the bricks are conceived as voussoirs, and the same in the great mosque at Cordoba, whereas at Toledo, I don't know if you can see the joins here, 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 it's conceived vertically, much in the same way as San Juan de Duero. And of four master masons documented at Toledo between 1226 and 1400, none has a Muslim name, and surely only a master mason could be responsible for such a prominent design. So I really think we don't have Muslim architects here. Yet these questions give us pause for thought. Given the very evident differences with all these Islamic models, have scholars been too quick to look to the south? This is certainly the case for Toledo's inner ambulatory, completed circa 1238, which some have again compared to Cordoba's Maxura. So Juan Carlos Ruiz Souza recently compared this design and triforium with the oculus above to what we have here in the Maxura at Cordoba with these openings above. Yet this design at Toledo also has resemblances with a number of churches in Nevada and the Paris region, all ultimately indebted to Notre Dame in Paris. So this combination of a triforium with an oculus above is quite common in French Gothic architecture. And as Christopher Wilson and Robert Bork have shown, the most convincing model for Toledo's design are the transepts at Beauvais Cathedral, where we have lobed arches in the triforium and also this quite complex tracery design. And Beauvais is a particularly appropriate model because it was the only church prior to Toledo where architects had attempted to wrap staggered double aisles into the transepts. So this just shows on Beauvais that the elevation that I was showing you. And the point about Toledo is that actually, unlike somewhere like Notre Dame or Bourges, the double aisles staggered plan is wrapped around the transepts so that you've actually got a very complex part of the construction going on around the transepts around here. And only at Beauvais prior to Toledo had that even been attempted. Moreover, the cessation of construction at Beauvais in 1232, 1233 may have caused its masons to head to Spain in search of work for which they had the necessary skills. So we've already seen this at Bamberg when work stopped at Reims. We know that those sculptors moved over to Germany. Something similar may have happened with Beauvais when work stopped there. It's harder to find comparable models for Toledo's presbytery triforium, though the closest models are probably the triforium at Burgos Cathedral. The similarities are distant. It's not really, I think, that similar to what we have at Toledo. But they do make me wonder if we shouldn't think about bar tracery here too as a possible model. Bar tracery came late to Castile. Its earliest examples date to the 1250s at León and Burgos. But roughly contemporary with these, so this is the western bay at Burgos Cathedral, where we can just see we've got these early forms of bar tracery. And here's a tomb of Martin Fernandez, who died in 1250. The tomb might be a little bit later. But I think contemporary with these, or more or less contemporary, are is the Eastern Triforium in Toledo's transepts, just around the corner from the Presbytery Triforium. So here we can see we're in the north transept looking south. We can see that presbytery area there, it's screened off. And on the east walls of the transepts, here and here, we have this tracery design. This is the view of it from the Triforium itself. This design is actually rather unusual because it has these inverted trilobes, so these trilobe features that are upside down, or contrary to the usual pattern. A fairly unusual feature that is found also, for instance, at Amiens, at Troyes, as you see here, and at Notre Dame in Paris, in the North Tower, well, all across the towers. Is it a coincidence, I wonder, that in 1255, Archbishop Sancho of Toledo stopped in Paris, where he had been schooled, on his way to Westminster to meet with King Henry III? For a cosmopolitan and ambitious archbishop like Sancho, Parisian Rayonnant architecture must have represented the very height of ecclesiastical splendour and sophistication, and it was nowhere more prominently displayed than on the west front of Notre Dame. So we know that the Archbishop of Toledo was in Paris in the 1250s, where he could have seen this. Yet whether Toledo's models are in Cordoba, Toledo itself, Paris or Beauvais, we still need to account for how these ideas were transferred. In the case of Beauvais, it seems likely that masons had travelled down to Toledo after 1233, or possibly that Toledo's French master mason, Martin, went there on a fact-finding mission. Sancho may have also found masons whilst in Paris in 1255, or maybe picked up other things. But the obvious conduit for these ideas was drawings. What evidence do we have for the circulation of drawings in medieval Iberia? The earliest accurate architectural drawings to survive from Northern Europe date to the early 13th century, but few survive from 13th or 14th century Iberia, even though paper was readily available. The earliest design that I know is that for a rose window from Leon Cathedral, which is on stone here. And the earliest drawing of an elevation that I know dates to 1345 and comes from Tortosa Cathedral, though it survives only in a later copy. Although I think yesterday that Mark was saying there might be a drawing for the Tower of Saint Filou. I don't know the date of that. But more and more drawings and tracings are being discovered here every year. So many more may emerge in coming years. And so just for fun, really, I put up this plan of Seville Cathedral, which was discovered just 3 years ago in an archive. And this, which I'm very interested in, which was discovered in the Cimborio of Cuenca Cathedral, which some have called a plan of Burgos, but I think that's very debatable. There was relatively little discussion of the circulation of accurate architectural drawings in the Islamic world either, and it remains a mystery, for instance, how copies of domes in Cordoba's great mosque were generated. It is generally considered that the earliest Islamic drawings survive from the 13th century, so from the same period as those from northern Gothic lodges. Though a design on one of the panels of the Arca Santa in Oviedo must date far earlier. The Arca may have been made in Toledo, but the function of the design is not clear. So this, which comes from one of the inner panels of the Arca Santa in Oviedo, bears no relationship to the covering on the outside. But if that Arca was made in Toledo, which it may have been, then we might think of a kind of Toledan provenance for that. And it's rather similar to those found in the minaret of the Kutubiyya Mosque in Marrakesh, which probably date to the late 12th century. I don't know if you can see those in this lab, but you may just be able to make out the traces of similar multi-lobed arches. At any rate, no architectural drawings survive in Toledo from before the 15th century, but then nor do they survive in England or all sorts of other places. If the master masons at Toledo were nonetheless used to working with drawings, and I'm sure they would have been, drawings of bar tracery or new Renan forms must have seemed to them hardly less exciting and exotic than drawings based on Islamic designs. I'll just show you here two examples of drawings of early, two early drawings of bar tracery or something here, the west facade of Strasbourg Cathedral in the plan from about the 1260s. Which must have seemed, if any architect in Toledo had seen them, as something really rather quite exotic. But if the architect responsible for Toledo's transept triforium had access to drawings of the towers at Paris, and we know that towers and west facades are the subject of some of the earliest drawings that survive, his final design by no means replicates them exactly. So, yes, we've got these inverted trilobes, but it's hardly an exact copy. So either we have to imagine that he adapted freely, or that he misunderstood the drawings, as VR sometimes did. So I don't know if you can see in this, but there's some rather strange sections to this triforium design, some odd kind of panels of stonework, which looks like maybe our architect wasn't used to bar tracery. Of course, the alternative is that he invented this freely. But I suspect a bit of both misunderstanding and free adaptation. But with this in mind, let us reconsider the design of the presbytery triforium and compare it with the Parisian towers. When we do this, I think we see that, in fact, the two are not so very different. And I'm talking about here the fact that on the Parisian towers we have the same cusped arches, and we can play, if we want, the same sort of game with these spaces as we did for the Great Mosque at Cordoba. When we look closely at this, it seems to me that Paris doesn't seem that much further away from Toledo than does Cordoba. So could Toledo's presbytery triforium be a first clumsy attempt to replicate new Renan forms based on a misreading of a drawing? Do these kinds of similarities mean anything at all, or were they just coincidences? In truth, I don't really think I believe that Toledo's master masons could have misread a drawing quite so badly. Nor do I think it likely that Archbishop Sancho got out quill and paper and made a quick amateur sketch whilst in Paris. But I do think that as architectural historians, we sometimes too often look for precise similarities, when actually it is the differences that are more interesting. How can we account, for instance, for a design that is reminiscent of another, but by no means the same? If the architect of Toledo's presbytery triforium intended it to imitate a local building, I suspect he could have done a better job. He could just go back and forwards and make a better imitation. Alternatively, of course, he could have just made up this design. But my best guess, and it is only a guess, is that the architect at Toledo had visited Cordoba and then at a later date sought to replicate its architectural forms, translating them into a more familiar Gothic vocabulary, but doing so from memory. That much is speculation. But scholars who have noticed these Islamicate forms at Toledo have only rarely asked why they were used. How do we account for this kind of design? Because there was certainly nothing inevitable about their presence. And indeed, the fact that this was never copied elsewhere, I think, suggests that either it had a very specific function in relation to Toledo, or that it wasn't seen as very satisfactory. I should incidentally say, I've not said this before, but these statues that we see in the triforum were added at a later date. Well, almost certainly. They come from a screen that was destroyed much later. So how do we account for these forms at Toledo? Although some have disputed it, I do believe that the conquests of Toledo in 1085, Cordoba in 1236, and Seville in 1248 represent important moments of architectural encounter. In part, the design of Toledo's triforium may be seen as a sign of admiration for these newly visible Andalusian forms, their imitation sanctioned by the conversion to Christian youth. So these forms, newly available in Cordoba and Seville, but available also in what were now cathedrals. There may also have been a competitive element to this. For those restored sees at Cordoba and especially Seville could potentially threaten Toledo's claims to primacy. And this use may even be deliberately archaic, an evocation of the mosque that had served as Toledo's cathedral after 1286. And certainly what it does, as much as anything, is signal the liturgical importance of the presbytery space compared to other places in the cathedral. But can we also read this iconographically in Krautheimer's original sense of the term? José Martínez de Aguirre has recently argued that both the dome of the Templar Church of Torres del Río and the peculiar portico of San Juan de Duero, a Hospitaller church, should be understood as evocations of buildings in Jerusalem. These, he believes, were mediated by way of the Toledan mosque of Bab al-Mardum, which passed the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem in 1183 and was consecrated to the Holy Cross, Santa Cruz, 3 years later. But Santa Cruz wasn't the only place in Toledo with devotion to the cross. In fact, there's a long tradition of Toledan devotion to the cross. In 1248, Juan Medina, Archbishop of Toledo, had attended the lavish consecration of the Sainte Chapelle in Paris, and a few months later received from Louis IX a precious relic of the true cross. It is recorded in Toledan inventories a few years later, installed in its own reliquary cross. But where is this precious relic kept? We know for certain that there was a chapel of the Holy Cross behind Toledo's high altar by 1289, when a local chronicle records that King Sancho IV translated the bodies of three kings there. Unfortunately, the whole area was entirely reformed in the 15th century, but we know that it was separated from the high altar by some sort of screen, and it can be pieced together with various bits of evidence. So this is a reconstruction of the high altar area. So here we are in the presbytery space of Toledo Cathedral. We know that the chapel of the Holy Cross with its altar was in this bay. We know that it was separated from the high altar by some sort of screen. It's a long argument to explain this arrangement. But I think it would have been rather like a combination of the east ends of León, Santiago de Compostela, and Westminster Abbey. We can see at Santiago, for instance, where we had a chapel located behind the high altar was accessed through two doors either side of the high altar. It's true of Westminster. At León, it was slightly different. But I think our arrangement to Toledo would have been something like those. I would also argue that a chapel of the Holy Cross had been intended for this space ever since the true cross relic first arrived in Toledo in 1249, and that the Archbishop Infante Sancho of Toledo was buried there at his death in 1261. So we know from later accounts that the tomb of Archbishop Sancho I was in this Holy Cross altar. It's not mentioned in the account of the translation of bodies in 1289, so I think he was probably always buried here at his death in 1261. So what matters here, in a sense, is that this space dedicated to the Holy Cross was overlooked by that extraordinary triforium design. Now, in the 15th century, an evocation of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem was made explicit by the construction of a crypt chapel below the Holy Cross Chapel, dedicated to the Holy Sepulchre. But even in the 13th century, were the curious interlaced arches of Toledo's Presbytery Triforium intended to evoke the exotic splendours of Jerusalem? And if so, what then of this remarkable vault? Complete by 1289, the date of those translations, this vault would be contemporary with the very earliest Lierne vaults in England. Its richness and complexity are worthy rival to the domes at Cordoba or Santa Cruz. And you can see here, I hope, in this vault, just how richly embellished this vault is, with combinations of dogtooth ornament, this kind of weird floral ornament. It's an incredibly rich and lavish vault. So if this was complete by 1289, when that chapel was definitively established, then it would be this design of these Lierne vaults would be, well, earlier or contemporary with the very first vaults that are known of this design in England. On the other hand, some people have argued that this vault was replaced in the 15th century, but I'm not persuaded at all by this design, this argument. If you compare it with vaults from the late 15th century, both the profile of these ribs and the whole design in total is very different from what we find at Toledo. So, actually, dating these vaults is very difficult, but my question is really here, why do we have such elaborate vaults? Is it simply to signal the importance of this as a high altar area, or does it have anything to do with this tradition of covering important spaces dedicated to the cross with particularly lavish vaults? If in this paper I've left lots of these questions unanswered, it is partly to invite your thoughts and comments. I think it is clear that Toledo needs more thought and more work, but this will only be possible if the cathedral authorities allow scholars to work more freely on the cathedral. So, for instance, a few years ago, an archive of the Royal Chapel was discovered at Toledo, but no one's been allowed to look at it. They're supposedly cataloguing it. I've only been able to see an index. But more than anything, I hoped to have shown here that Toledo should not embody some sort of scholarly or political binary. It belongs to an architectural discourse that spreads from Marrakesh to Westminster and should belong to an academic and popular discourse with the same ambition and scope. Toledo Cathedral should not be seen as the embarrassingly conservative uncle in the otherwise happy Convivencia family. Families have complex histories and relationships, and they can only be understood by understanding all of their parts. Thank you.
Muchísimas gracias. Bueno, hemos empezado con una panorámica, yo creo que algo desoladora, sobre la Toledo actual, con las espadas del Señor de los Anillos, con los mazapanes y con reflexiones acerca del estudio actual y las dificultades que hay para acceder a algunos recintos catedralicios para abordar algunos estudios que son problemas actuales y que nos encontramos algunos profesores, ¿no? En cierto modo, ha habido alguna conexión con la conferencia de Claudia, porque ha salido otra vez Franco, en este caso, uno de los instigadores de Toledo como capital de las tres culturas, cuando él, en realidad, al comienzo de su gobierno, iba con la Guardia Mora y bueno, cuando tenía problemas e intentaba definir a sus enemigos, los definía como una trilogía, digamos, conspirativa de judíos, masones y comunistas, y por tanto él pretende una unión cuando ni él mismo se la creía. Luego el discurso ya ha abordado el tema de modelos ornamentales y cómo explica la aportación de estos modelos decorativos de distintos edificios en Toledo y, bueno, nos ha regalado también información sobre dibujos que yo al menos desconocía acerca de cabeceras y, bueno, muy interesante. Si alguien tiene alguna pregunta, es el momento para aprovechar y que Tom nos conteste. Isabel.
Una pregunta. Es que lo que he visto aquí en Gerona es que el contraste es muy, muy grande, que me parece que aquí toda la conservación de la ciudad, de la catedral también, que hay buenas relaciones con la universidad y todo. En Toledo hay un problema que la Universidad de Castilla-La Mancha es muy joven y no hay esta tradición de trabajar juntos. Pero a Toledo tengo que decir que hay que morir unos de estos canónigos
muy matar.
Viejos que han estado ahí desde los años de Franco.
Matar, sí. Quiere decir matar.
Es que es verdad que hay canónigos aún ahí que han escrito artículos en los años 60 y 70 en que dicen que los judíos fueron expulsados por sus propias faltas y aún esta gente está en el cabildo y todo. Entonces hay que decir que es mucho mejor ahora que aún hace 10 años, que los archivos son más accesibles, que están
digitalización.
Sí, de todos los fondos del archivo. Entonces, es que necesitan las autoridades creer que las investigaciones no representan problemas para ellas, pero oportunidades. Pero cómo hacerlo, no sé exactamente.
Es que incluso en algunos casos hay duplicidad o sea, dentro de la misma institución no son los mismos responsables los que te dejan entrar en un sitio o en otro. Entonces, a lo mejor tienes relativa facilidad en entrar, por ejemplo, a un claustro y, en cambio, a la iglesia no, porque sí. la competencia, digamos, es de otra persona, que a lo mejor es mucho más rígido, ¿no?
Sí.
Yo creo que habría que elaborar un plan para matar a alguien y, si funciona, pues dedicarnos a todas las catedrales que suponen un problema. Nos mantendremos a la expectativa. Isabel.
Absolutamente excepcional, y lo digo yo que vengo dentro de la otra universidad, y reconozco que
Bueno, si hay alguna otra pregunta, si no, nos espera un café aquí fuera. No, perdona, Claudia quiere comentar.
Sí. Con estas figuras,
sí, los encuentran en el triforio de Burgos, por ejemplo. No es exactamente igual, pero se ven esas cabezas aquí.
No, pero no es lo mismo.
Dentro de estas partes, no son tan grandes en los otros ejemplos, creo. Pero estas figuras son, creo, que no fueron ahí originalmente.
¿Pero de arriba?
Sí, los de arriba sí. Los de arriba sí, esos no. Y hacen como... hay una gran variedad de cabezas. Pero creo que están bregando, orando y todo esto, pero no hay algo específico. Pero hay que decir que detrás del retablo mayor se ve en el triforio hay las figuras originales que son más temprano que este retablo, y ahí se ve hay inscripciones y todo, y la pintura original, y también hay figuras, hay más figuras como este en las enjutas, pero yo tuve la oportunidad solamente de 2 minutitos en el triforio, no pude investigarlo realmente, y ahora no se permite acceder al triforio.
Pero esto no recuerda a la escalera de caracol de la Catedral de Oviedo, que hay como unos óculos con gente que pretende salir, como si fuera se asomaran a una ventana. Esther, ¿tú te acuerdas de esto? Pues en Orense.